NPR News, Washington.
President Obama is sending Congress a proposal he says would make it quicker and easier to trim what he calls wasteful costs from congressional spending bills. The Reduce Unnecessary Spending Act of 2010 would let the president submit a package of cuts or rescissions to Congress after it passes one of the annual spending or appropriations bills. A new study in the journal Pediatrics finds children in the most rural parts of the U.S. are as likely to die from gunshot wounds as kids in the largest cities. The study shows that while murders are more common in cities, gun suicides and accidental fatal shootings are more common among rural children. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Citrix, offering Go to My PC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere at gotomypc.com/NPR.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is WILL Chief Meteorologist Ed Keezer. Tornadoes are a dangerous part of the weather here in central Illinois, so it's important to know what to do when a storm threatens. Join me on May 25th when Parkland College presents my 20th annual Tornado Safety Show. That's Tuesday, May 25th at 7 p.m. at the Parkland College Theater in Champaign. Admission is $1. For more information, call 351-2567.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Family life in America has changed pretty dramatically in the last 50 years. Now, that's not big news, but there is something that's perhaps a little bit more subtle going on here. And that is that these changes, the changes that we're all familiar with, have played out in ways that are very uneven. In the first hour of program today, we'll be talking with Naomi Kahn. She is professor of law at George Washington University Law School. She's also the co-author of a recently published book that we'll be talking about. The title of the book is Red Families versus Blue Families, Legal Polarization and the Creation of Culture. And the book is published by the Oxford University Press. In the book, our guest, Professor Kahn, and her co-author make this argument that there is a very close connection between where families live, what they believe, and how well they are doing. She also says that the culture wars that rage in national politics today mask the ways that family values may have contributed to economic inequality. The book is out now in the bookstores if you'd like to take a look at it. And as we talk this morning on the program, questions are welcome. Now, if you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send your comments along by email, you may do that. And the address is will-talk, so will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, if you have questions or comments, you're welcome to share them. We do ask people to try to be brief just so we could keep moving along. But people who are listening, they are welcome to call. Professor Kahn, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I think just maybe we can start with this basic point, and then we can try to get into some detail. As I stated, and I hope that I did that correctly, that that there is this very close connection between geography and attitudes towards some of the key issues of our time, and the economic well-being of families.
Well, what we found in our book, we found that there are really, in the United States, two family systems. And one of them is in crisis, while the other is doing reasonably well. We identified the two family systems as red versus blue. The blue family is the one that invests in women as well as men. It also, importantly, delays family formation until young adults are emotionally and financially ready to have families. And then it also views sexuality as a private matter. The red family system, by contrast, is a more traditional one that continues to preach abstinence, early marriage, and more traditional gender roles. Now, we called them red versus blue. The blue families tend to be clustered in states that voted blue, that is, Democratic, in the past two presidential elections. And the red ones tend to be clustered in the red states, but there are plenty of blue families in red states and red families in blue states. What we're talking about is a set of beliefs that each different family has about family formation and family values and sexuality.
I think this is really interesting and something that I think as you look at all of these intensely debated hot button issues, something that may be lost where people, unless this is your area of study, may not be have been something you notice, but that a key point seems to be one big difference between these the two kinds of families and how well they do has to do with the age at which people start their families.
That's exactly right. We actually started, my co-author Jean Carbone, who teaches at UMKC, University of Missouri, Kansas City, and I backed into this because we started by looking at evolutionary biology. And so we started looking at animals, and then somehow that led us, because we both teach family law, into looking at the age of marriage. And if you look at when people, not just when people get married, but at when they start their families, there is a large difference between people who start their families before the age of 20 or 21 and those who start after that age. And it's always been true. Teen marriages have always been quite risky. But today, every increase in the age of marriage reduces the likelihood that the couple will divorce. So the older you are when you get married, the less likely you are to ever get divorced. Again, I want to emphasize, we're talking about statistics, and we're not talking about every teen marriage, or for that matter, everybody who gets married at the age of 29 and then doesn't have children until their mid to late 30s. But statistically, you're absolutely right. The age of family formation is incredibly important in determining stability. And so Massachusetts, which has one of the oldest ages of marriage, also has the lowest divorce rate in the country.
So just again, I think though on the face of it, we're saying we are painting with a little bit of a broad brush, but on the other hand, I would think that people would generally accept the notion that people who get married later in life are probably more mature, have a little bit more life experience, have a little more sense where they're going, maybe make a better choice of partner, are more mature when it comes time to having children. And also, then the other thing that's going on here is for those people who are delaying marriage, during the time that they're delaying marriage, what they're doing is they're going to college and they're building careers so that then when those people come together, they have a stronger economic base to build the marriage on. And then that seems also to be something that, not surprisingly, contributes to their success.
Absolutely. It used to be that if you graduated from high school, you were pretty sure of having a fairly secure job for the rest of your life. And so if in that kind of an environment, getting married at a younger age isn't associated with economic stability, and there's much less of a need to go to college. But in the new information economy, where more education is rewarded with higher paying jobs, you're absolutely right. If you delay family formation, then that's a time period during which you are likely to be able to accumulate the additional education that will then lead to higher income and more stable jobs and more stable families. And this is a change in the overall economy. If you look at where jobs have been growing in our economy, to the extent there's been any growth in jobs, The increases, at least until the recession, were coming in the more in the jobs that demanded higher education, as well as in the most low-skilled jobs. And so people in the middle were being squeezed out by the new information economy.
So there, that's one thing that I think is worth pointing out when people talk about what's happened in terms of changes of family life, that economics, changes in the economy, have had an enormous amount to do with it because, as you point out, there would have been a time when a single worker could support a family at a middle-class standard with a high school education, but no more. So that has changed. But then there's also been another big thing, and this is something that some people maybe they're not sure is such a good thing, is that this association, the association between having sex, having children, and getting married has been broken, and that's because of access to reliable contraception.
Oh, absolutely. Once the pill is introduced in 1960, I mean, this is the 50th anniversary of the pill, you give certainly women a lot more freedom over reproduction. And so if, if women became pregnant or were unable to prevent pregnancy, then the solution in the 50s was to get married. Once you give women and men, too, more control over the means of reproduction, it means that being sexually intimate does not then necessarily lead to pregnancy. And as a result, in the late 1960s, the number of women who went to college, there's an incredible increase in the number of women in college and the percentage of people in college who are women, just because there is much more control over sexuality. Now, the other argument that we hear is, well, but if you make the pill available, then you're going to be encouraging people to have sex. And the answer to that is, while it is certainly desirable, and I have teenage daughters, to encourage abstinence, it's also important to know that if abstinence isn't in fact going to be happening, that there is a means of protecting oneself. And the rates of, if you look at what happens to teen moms, if you look at what happens to them and to their children, their rates of high school graduation, much less college graduation, are far lower than women who give birth at a later age. So being able to control your reproductive capabilities provides an enormous impetus to changes in the family and then to later childbearing.
Let me introduce very quickly again our guest for this hour, Naomi Kahn. She's professor of law at George Washington University Law School and also senior fellow at the Evan Donaldson Adoption Institute. Family law is her special area of interest. She is the co-author, along with June Carbone, who teaches law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
Yeah.
They are the co-authors of the book Red Families versus Blue Families, and it's just recently come out from the Oxford University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Just let me ask you about one thing particularly, because it's the kind of thing that worries people a great deal and seems to be one of the things that people like to point to as a cultural indicator, and that is teen pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, admittedly, when we're talking about red and blue, this is something of a shorthand. But if you take a look at the rates of teen pregnancy in the so-called red states and the so-called blue states and in red and blue families, what is it that you find?
Well, the rates of teen pregnancy are actually somewhat similar in many of the red and blue states. What's different is what happens to those teen pregnancies. And in blue states or in blue families, there's a lower rate of teen birth versus in red states, there's a higher rate of 18 birth. And I think what red and blue states would all agree on is the importance of reducing the teen pregnancy rate, and there would then be disagreement on what to do about the teen birth rate, because presumably what's happening in those blue families is that the teens are no longer pregnant because there's been an abortion. And that is certainly a hot-button issue.
Well, that does, and I know that some of the commentators who have looked at the book, this is the thing that they go to, and that they say, well, yes, while it's true that there are, in the blue states and among blue families, there are fewer births to teen mothers, but they say also there are more abortions. And so that for people that they would say who argue that good sex education and access to contraception is the issue, then, and they're concerned about abortion, then they're going to say, but see, we still have a problem here because we've got teenage girls who are getting pregnant, and the only difference is that instead of having those babies, they're having abortions.
Right, and that certainly is a big issue. And what June and I want to do is to back up the conversation and to look at what teens are being taught in school about sex education, and then their access to birth control to prevent these overwhelmingly unintended and often unwanted pregnancies. And so it's important to focus on contraception and on preventing these pregnancies from happening. And it's not just giving girls and women access to birth control or even to sex education that does that. What's important is being able to continue with your education, having something to look forward to in terms of being able to continue your education, and knowing that, in fact, if you defer childbearing, that you will be able to establish a career and provide even better for the children that you ultimately do have. And if you look at the reasons that many women give when they have an abortion, it's so that they can better provide for their future children. So abortion is not for anybody a good solution, but it is a backstop when education, when sex education, when contraception have all failed. The other thing to look at alternatives to abortion, such as adoption or keeping the child, if you're going to make those realistic alternatives, then you've got to provide good means of supporting the adoption alternative, providing adequate health care during the pregnancy. Or if you are anti-abortion, you need to provide support for that girl or young woman to be able to care for the child and then continue her education. So abortion is a very important component, but even if you don't believe in abortion, it's important to provide teen moms with alternatives, with help and support in caring for their babies or in giving their babies up for adoption.
Well, just one more point, and then I have some callers I want to get to. I think clearly what you and your co-author are arguing for is to, in a number of ways, to take, I think, that this conversation about family values to take the heat level down just a little bit, and that one of the things that you are arguing for, as you've said, is to maybe try to get away from abortion being at the heart of the conversation and move over to contraception, to family planning.
Exactly.
And I think that there are probably a lot of people would say that makes a lot of sense. It seems, though, that also, though, then lands us back in that same other argument that says that for people who truly believe that people should be having sex before they get married, that they're saying, well, but that gets us back to the thing that somehow if we give information about contraception and we make that available, it's like we're giving permission. And that way, what we've done is that we have backed off from what we think is a very important value. And that is, as far as they're concerned, that marriage and sex should be connected. And it seems that's still going to be, with a lot of people, that's going to be a non-starter.
Well, the other important thing to think about, and June, who was raised Catholic, has some wonderful stories about this, is if you teach people about contraception, you're not saying use this before you get married. You're teaching people about what happens when they get married as well. Even I lived in Africa for 2 years from 2002 to 2004, and the fertility rate, I was in the Congo, the fertility rate was 7 or 8 children per woman. And one of the, a lot of the organizations that were working there were emphasizing the importance of spacing children. Nothing wrong with having 7 or 8 children, but the maternal mortality rate in the Congo was also incredibly high. If you space children, then you are going to have a lower maternal mortality rate and, at least in that country, certainly more resources for each child. So certainly internationally, there's an argument for teaching even married women about contraception. But then if you also look at who in the United States uses contraception, more than 90% of all women have used some form of contraception during their lifetime, and it goes up even higher when you include the rhythm method, which is, of course, a form of contraception as well. So just because you're teaching high school students or even middle school students about what to do to prevent conception when you are ready to have sex, just because you're teaching that doesn't mean you're saying, okay, now use that as a teenager. You're teaching that as part of the life skills that you're teaching them. And if they do, in fact, abstain until they are married, then this could still be quite useful, given that the incredibly overwhelming majority of women in the United States will in fact use some form of contraception. You're preparing these boys and girls for their future lives. I'll stop there.
Okay. Well, we have a caller here. Let's talk with him in Effingham, line one. Hello.
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 Thanks for taking my call. I wondered if you, ma'am, have heard the term humatrix.
Humatrix?
Yes.
No.
No. Okay. Well, the gist of the conversation, I had to ask so I would understand that. The Humatrian Society, in my opinion, covered all the bases when the humatrix preceded the matriarchy. And after matriarchy, it all came apart. And paternal males then became patriarchs. And here we are in a mad, mad world. And I don't have any evidence of this, but in nature, there are dominant males who would take the gonads of the young males, ensuring their dominance, and that sort of practice, and I think humans are no different. All the invention that our intellect has provided us, you know, our dialectic of our environment, and who survives and who doesn't, and why, is the only way. If we don't go back and revisit that, we'll continue on as it is now, with the male dominance, I think some females, I don't like using that term, female, the evolution from humatric to themetric, then into the domination of males, has provided the discombobulation of human existence. And where are we going? And when we get married, and when young people are sexually repressed, I mean from day one, and dominant fathers and weak mothers, where her role has been one to produce the young, and then as soon as they are off the breast or the bottle, then male dominance begins to expose itself. So if I went far afield, I'm sorry for that. But nevertheless, unless we go back to the history, then we're going to keep on heading for the wall, and speed is picking up, I'm afraid, you know, vis-a-vis down here in the Gulf. Thank you.
Thank you. I will certainly check out the Humatrians, and this is also an opportunity for me to go back to, as I mentioned, where June and I started, which is evolutionary biology. And the research in evolutionary biology on male and female roles is incredibly fascinating, just for the diversity that it shows in early cultures. And there's also, there have been a series of different paradigms. There have been a series of different ways of thinking about our evolutionary past. And there, we're still in the process of discovering what exactly, or how to think about what was going on in our evolutionary past. There's, for example, a great deal more credence now given to a grandmother hypothesis, the importance of grandmothers in nurturing their grandchildren, and the importance of the food gathering that grandmothers were able to give to the children. So when we look at the lessons to learn from history, it's actually kind of a complicated story. Now, what we do talk about in the book is some of the ways that we might think about moving forward to try to make sure that, or not to try to make sure, but to try to overcome some of the cultural values gaps that are tearing the country apart when it comes to things like abortion or same-sex marriage or abstinence education. And so looking forward, there are lots and lots of steps that we can take in order to try to resolve some of these family values debates.
Well, let me ask you this, and it's something that I know that you've thought about. Why is it, do you think, that this constellation of issues that comes under the heading of family values has taken center stage in American politics?
We suggest that there's a cultural anxiety about what's going on with the family. The family is changing. The non-marital birth rate, the percentage of children born outside of marriage is at an all-time high of about 40%. And in certain communities, it's a lot higher. So there is, in fact, some cultural anxiety over all of these changes in the family. Now, ironically, the families that are most in jeopardy are the ones that hold traditional ideas about gender roles, and the dynamic in these families then increases a susceptibility to a family values political message. And so because you're anxious about your own family, you might then become a lot more anxious nationally about what is happening to other people's families. And so you may be more likely to then become concerned with a whole series of different family values issues. And so as you talk more to people who share your values, and in fact that's happening a lot, then you're going to become more and more anxious, which then increases these issues. But families, we all have families. We all live in families, something we think about every single day. And if your family is not as stable as you'd like, if something is going on in your family that you're not happy about, it might make you want to cling to a traditional set of values.
We're a little bit past the midpoint. I have another call we'll get right to. Let me just very quickly introduce our guest for this hour, Naomi Kahn. She teaches law at George Washington University Law School. She is the co-author, along with June Carbone, who teaches law at University of Missouri, Kansas City. They're the co-authors of the recent book, Red Families versus Blue Families, the subtitle, Legal Polarization and the Creation of Culture. It's published by the Oxford University Press, in which they make this argument that different families in different parts of the country are living very different lives, and they divide along the lines where American politics divide. There's a big difference in how families are doing, and you can also tie that to how people believe, what people believe about some of the key political issues of our time and where they live, all that bound up together. If you're interested, you've got to look at the book. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have someone who clearly must be listening on the internet. They are in Seattle, Washington. Next up, line four. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted some clarification from an earlier point. I believe the guest said that the real difference between the red state and blue state pregnancy is not about the actual pregnancy rate, but it's about the birth rate. And I found that surprising because it kind of implies that it doesn't matter which family model you're using. It's the contraception rate would be happening, if I'm drawing the right conclusion, the same way, whether it's a red family or a blue family. So I want to make sure I heard that right and try and get some explanation. If so, it kind of takes the idea that we need to focus on getting families to accept the idea of contraception and turns it on its head, because based on those numbers, it doesn't seem like it matters at all.
Yep, Professor Kahn.
Okay, well, one of the problems is that our teens don't have enough information about contraception, which may be why we have these pregnancy rates. Most unmarried young adults, and here I'm actually going into the 20s, have had sex, but they also, and I'm talking about like essentially 18 to 29 with a focus on the younger ones. But the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy said that many unmarried young adults know little or nothing about contraception, even the most commonly used methods. 30%, and this is 18 to 29-year-olds, say they know little or nothing about condoms. 63% say they know little or nothing about birth control pills, and more than 50% said they had not heard of the birth control implant. So there is some information that a lot of teens and then young adults are not getting about contraception, about what it is, how to use it, much less how to access it. And so making sure that more and better education about contraception gets out there would ideally and hopefully affect the teen pregnancy rates and then the teen birth and abortion rates in both red and blue states. But if you think about it, it's kind of surprising, but many unmarried young adults say they not only that they know little about the most commonly used methods of contraception, but that they are confused about their own fertility. So they may not realize when they are most likely to be fertile and thus most likely to conceive. And they also have lots of myths about contraception. They underestimate the effectiveness of contraception, and then they just don't have a good sense of the risks and benefits of contraception. So yes, it's interesting that it's hard to prevent teens from having sex in the first place, but which is true in both red and blue families. But what's important is that teens are not getting the information they need when they do start to become sexually active. You can try to prevent them from becoming sexually active. You can say, we don't want you to use birth control until you're married. But even then, a lot of them don't know very much about the basic methods of contraception. And so I think that's, I think that the caller has a really interesting point when we focus on the pregnancy rates, but then you got to back it up and look at contraception and look at abstinence education and at the problems that more than a decade of abstinence education have caused with respect to knowledge and understanding of basic forms of contraception.
Well, though it leaves me wondering why it might be that in blue families where we have the expectation that they believe in good sex education for their kids and informing them about contraception, and at the same time, some people would say, there's a problem with this, but at the same time, them saying, look, we want you to delay sexual activity, but if you are going to be sexually active, we want you to use contraception because for a lot of reasons, it's not a good idea for you at your age to get pregnant. Why is it that you think that the blue families aren't doing a better job of educating their children in those values that we have led to believe that that's what blue families believe? Why aren't their kids getting the message?
I think that that's a good question. I mean, part of it is that if they go to public schools and they're getting abstinence education in public schools, then one of the primary sources of information about contraception is abstinence, and they're not getting the information that my two teen girls are getting in our local public school about different forms of contraception. So part of it is the national push towards abstinence education, which is changing, but it's just changing now as a result of President Obama's budget. There's also issues in families that can't afford birth control. There's also issues of public access. And then there, in general, when you put clinics in high schools, that makes it easier for all students to be able to access it. So there are issues of access. There are issues of, again, abstinence education. And then there's the fact that we're talking about teens whose brains are still in the process of becoming developed, and they are neuroscientific studies on teens' brains show that they're still less likely to completely understand all of the risks that they are taking.
We talked a little bit earlier about the kind of argument, the saying that, you know, we can try to make more progress on these very divisive issues if we change the terms of the debate. And one thing that we talked a bit about and you suggest is that maybe we could take so much of the focus off of debate around abortion and move it to talking about contraception. Let me ask you about something different that you also talk about, and that is to talk more about work and mm-hmm. about the relationship between work and family. Maybe the fact that the workplace, in many respects, has not responded very well to the needs of people who have families. Mm-hmm. What would happen if we started to talk much more about work than about family?
I think what we need to do is to talk more about work and family together, and then also, as you've heard me say, another theme is education. But we are one of the few industrialized countries that doesn't offer paid family leave. So when we're talking about ways of supporting the combination of work and family, that's certainly one option. So we think it's important to talk about both work and family. And for blue families, the problem is, or the issue is, challenging the workplace to make sure that the family fits in. And so that would be things like perhaps more childcare on site. It might also mean longer my children hate when I say this, but it might mean longer days of school or longer school years, so that the school year is more likely to fit around the workplace, shorter summer vacations, et cetera. And for red families, the challenge is to make sure that if you have a child at a younger age, that doesn't then mean that you can no longer continue with your education, or that you can't get a job, or that childcare issues are going to interfere with your job if that's in fact what you choose. So for red families, there are also workplace issues just of restructuring the relationship of the workplace to the family to make sure that the workplace can accommodate families, and also to make sure that the workplace supports additional education, so that if you've had to go to work to support your family, that you then have the opportunity to acquire additional skills. So we do need to, yes, we do need to think more about how work can accommodate the interests of both red and blue families, how it can accommodate their families as well as continued education.
I know that there are a lot of people who have argued that government should be involved in promoting the interests of families and family welfare, and depending on, you know, who you are, that might mean different things. There have been people over the past couple of decades who have argued that one of the big problems that we have here is that we don't have enough people getting married. And so somehow that the government ought to be promoting the idea of marriage. I suppose there are some people who think that would go some way to dealing with unwed mothers, I guess, if they could get them to marry, or at the very least to get people married and have them try to form a more stable kind of family. So I guess this question is then, do you see some role there for government, and at what sort of level of government do you think that it's appropriate for government to be getting involved with families?
Well, the government has undertaken various marriage promotion activities. What's ironic is that in blue families, the divorce rate is so much lower than in red families, because if you get married at a younger age, there's just so much risk that there will be such changes that various things will happen and that you will then get divorced. And so rather than marriage promotion by itself, it seems important to promote the ability to make reasonable decisions about the directions in which you want your life to be proceeding. If you have two people who haven't graduated from high school getting married, yeah, you potentially have two incomes, but you've still got two people who haven't graduated from high school and whose job prospects are going to be relatively, or financial possibilities will be relatively limited, again, statistically. And so simply promoting marriage doesn't in and of itself create more stable families. In the era of shotgun marriages, that didn't mean that those marriages were necessarily going to be particularly stable. And what instead is more important than promoting marriage, because marriage is not a solution it's a solution in that it legitimates children, but it's not going to be a solution to acquiring additional education. It's not going to be a solution if the parents then divorce. It's not going to be a solution if there's so much conflict that the parents should be divorcing. What's more important, again, is to back it up and to invest in education, to invest in opportunities. And then, as I said, the irony is that in a blue family where the marriages are later and the childbearing is later, you actually are going to be having fewer divorces.
That does seem to be one of the ironies of this story, is that in, and again, I guess I've feel like I have to say yes, we are making some generalizations because you have to be you have to be careful, and you because there certainly are subtle differences here. But having said that, that it seems that in those families that are more quote unquote liberal in their attitudes about family, that in fact those families, when you look at them, are really more conservative in the sense that we have more, there's less divorce, they're more solid two-parent households, and that actually they are much more, to a greater extent, embodying that ideal of the family than people who live in the red states. Now, and again, that you can definitely make some big exceptions. Utah, for example, is a huge exception. So that doesn't necessarily mean that red families in red states can't be doing well. But there does seem to be that difference.
Right, and people who live in, I mean, for example, Utah, and I know we've gotten comments from people who live in Utah who said, well, Utah is not quite as problem-free as people think. But in general, what lots of studies have found is that if you live within a relatively small community that reinforces your life choices, and so that says, okay, you've gotten married, we reinforce you getting married at a young age, and we'll provide all of the support that we can for that. If you live in those communities, then in fact, yes, you can get married at an early age and have a very low divorce rate and be much more likely to succeed. So in relatively small communities, that's absolutely what happens. It's when you look on a national scale that you get the sort of irony that we found as we looked at the age of family formation and as we looked at the relationship between the age of family formation and the different values that were held by the people who actually form these families. And I appreciate that you keep on saying we're talking about statistics. We're painting in very, very large brush strokes here, and there are all kinds of exceptions to what we found, and there are also variations based on class and race.
Sure.
Instead, what we're primarily talking about are these larger family systems, these larger sets of values, and we're also talking about the different laws that come into play that are associated with, they don't cause necessarily, but certainly the laws that are associated with these different family systems.
We have maybe about 5 or 6 minutes left. Naomi Kahn is our guest. She teaches law at George Washington University Law School. She is the co-author, along with June Carbone from the University of Missouri. They're co-authors of the book Red Families Versus Blue Families, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. If someone wants to call real quick, we can try to get him in. In the minutes that remain, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think ultimately the thing that you're suggesting, and I don't know whether such a thing is realistic or not, but is that you're suggesting that there might actually be some way to try to overcome this red-blue, this divide, this very heated debate that never quite seems to go anywhere, by nudging both the people on both sides of the debate, sort of nudging them towards the middle. And the idea would be, would it be actually possible to create some purple families, if you will, who are kind of a little bit of both, occupying a kind of middle ground where there's going to be much more agreement on what a healthy family is?
We think we're like everybody else in not wanting the family values debate to be such an issue of critical importance in the country that the Supreme Court frequently hears cases or turns down hearing cases involving these issues, such that state legislatures have to deal with this, that the health care bill was hung up for weeks over the abortion issue. We think it's really important to try to figure out ways of moving beyond all of this and perhaps, yes, of forming purple families. And one of the issues, in addition to focusing on issues where everyone agrees, which is, we hope everyone agrees, which are on things like preventing unwanted teen pregnancies on structuring the workplace so that it can better accommodate families. Another issue is figuring out what to do, what optimal ages of family formation are, and then of providing the opportunities to, perhaps for blue families, of having children at an earlier age, and red families of having children at a later age. So of trying to move to the middle on some of these issues. So one of the things we want to do is move to the middle on some of these issues, and the other thing we want to do is find places where there probably is a national consensus. Another area where there's national consensus is everybody cares about what's in the best interests of children and in creating and supporting families that are most likely to promote a child's best interest. Where we disagree, of course, is on how exactly to do that. But that at least provides another basis for thinking about how we can perhaps move towards the middle and not, for example, have weeks and weeks and weeks in various people's careers ruined because of issues like abortion in the national healthcare debate.
You know, I think, though, that you have to wonder, and it's something that I think that you certainly observe, that people running for office have found that these issues are great ones to get their base agitated, excited, and active. And as we know, in recent American politics, a small number of people can get things to go one way or another, and it does seem to be that there are fewer and fewer people who are occupying the middle.
I think that's right. I mean, you also see that, you see that in religion, you see that in public policy, you see that at the level of politicians whose rhetoric has gotten more extreme as a way of appealing to the base. I mean, if you just look at what's gone on in religion, people are more likely to now attend churches or other religious institutions which are in accord with their values. So they've started to do, there's a lot more shopping to find people who share the same values. And that means that as you're more likely to talk to those people, you're less likely to talk to people who have contrasting views with yours. And there's all kinds of social science research that shows that when you talk to people who share your views, you become more extreme. When you talk to people who are of different views, then you're much more likely to start to move towards the middle. So as the rhetoric becomes more extreme, as you associate with people who share your values and perspectives, you're also then less likely to tolerate people on the other side.
Well, there we're going to have to stop. We are coming to the end of this first hour of Focus. If you'd like to read more on the subject, the book is Red Families versus Blue Families, Legal Polarization and the Creation of Culture. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And our guest is the co-author Naomi Kahn. She is professor of law at George Washington University Law School. Professor Kahn, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Well, we've reached the midpoint of Focus this morning. In the next hour, we'll be taking questions on women's health with obstetrician and gynecologist Dr. Suzanne Troopin.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring the exhibit Helen May Butler and Her Ladies, the New American Brass Band from the Smithsonian Institute. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
And we'll take a break at this point, as we usually do, so we can bring you news from National Public Radio right now, an update on the agriculture markets.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
And right now in Kansas City, we're seeing wheat for July at 494 and three quarters, down one quarter. September, 506 and a half, down a half. And December at 524 and a quarter, down one quarter. Chicago wheat for July at 471 and a quarter is down 3/4. September at 488 and a quarter, down 1. And December 2010 at 519 and a quarter, down 3/4. Corn in the green, July at 371 and 3/4, up 2 3/4. September at 380 and a quarter, up 3.5. December at 389 and a quarter, up 4. March at 401, up 3 3/4. And May at 408 and 3/4, up 3 1/4. Crude oil for July at 70.21, up 17 cents. Ethanol at 159, and that's virtually unchanged. The RBOB gasoline at 197, and that's up just a bit over a penny. July soybeans at 9.43 3/4, up 2 3/4. August at 9.39 1/4, up 6. September 9.23 1/4, up 8. November 9.18 1/4, up 10 3/4. January 9.27 1/4, up 11 1/4. And March 2011 soybeans 9.35 1/2.